quiet, numbskulls. I'm broadcasting.
Hello, you're listening to the podcast, so there I was. This is episode 102, Warplane.
What a great book.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, the professor is our guest. He's the author, and Hal Sunt is his name. And I couldn't wait to tell him. I enjoyed the book. I mean, I couldn't put it down.
It was a fun book.
Very well written.
Yeah, it was. I thought I had a lot more to go, and I was so disappointed. I read it on a Kindle. So the Kindle tells you how many more pages there are. I thought, well, gee, I'm about halfway through this book. And I went back to read the rest of it, and it was done in like two pages. I'm like, wait, what? And it was all his Zen matter and his research. It's so well researched and thoroughly done. So Hal Sunt's a professor at Oberlin College who wrote a book about the most fascinating man you've never heard of. And he's the gent who's widely regarded as the father of the A-10, a gent by the name of Pierre Spray, who has a fascinating life story from his family leaving, born in 37 in France, his family leaving France to avoid the Nazis and getting out through Casablanca to, what do you say, going to Yale at 15, majoring in French literature and mechanical engineering.
Because they go hand in hand.
Yeah.
Right? But of course.
And then he talks a lot about the gentleman himself. What a self-assured pursuer of the truth, I guess is the way to do it. And how he became part of the group known as the Reformers, who insisted that the A-10 be done right. Yeah, the Whiz Kids by
Whiz Kids.
Secretary McNamara in the 60s.
Which was, I guess he kind of explained it as a, they were not really accountants, but they were, what's the term I'm looking
auditor?
For? Auditors,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And so they weren't popular because of that.
Yeah, and Pierre was truly an outcast of even the Whiz Kids because he did not tow, you know, he wasn't toting the party line.
No.
He was spot on all the time, and he didn't care whose feathers he ruffled.
Right, and the book talks all about how he wrote a memo that was headed to the president's desk, and the Air Force didn't like it. And they sicked guys on that memo to debunk it and couldn't.
Couldn't debunk it. So. Yep. Book opens with a great scene from Afghanistan where the A-10s are providing close air support, and boy, it hooked me right there.
Bingo. It really did. And he talked a whole lot about the whole process of developing this airplane, and some of it was fascinating. Bagos here with us this evening doing this intro. Tell us what your impression was of that whole process, how they included folks.
Yeah, but the professor goes into such detail about everything he's seen and done or had the opportunity to learn about, and it's done in such a layman's term that we can all enjoy and understand. The thing that got me was learning during the testing phase, the fact of maintenance was actually a category they cared about to ensure was done properly, which was a nice change for once for aircraft design.
As a former aircraft mechanic, well, I guess still, technically, you always are.
Could appreciate still. That, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Can appreciate the simplicity of that.
Exactly. You're going to love this book. It's Warplane, How the Military Reformers Birthed the A-10 Warthog by Hal Sunt, S-U-N-D-T. Highly recommend you go out and get that for yourself. Couple quick admin notes before we get out of the way. Thank you so much to our supporters, Michelle Langseth, who put another $100 in our coffers. Thank you very much. J-W-H, call sign.
Init.
Because that's all we got. His initials.
That's all we got.
He's a new section lead, so thank you very much. On Patreon, section lead, JWH, Inits. Thank you, Inits. And I wanted to mention that Rosie's book is up. Episode 95, Nose Gunner from World War II in the B-24 in Italy. He had written a memoir, said he was never going to publish it, and he felt so comfortable after chatting with us and got the feeling that we actually wanted to hear his story that he decided to share his memoir with us and gave us permission to put it up on our website.
So awesome.
Yep. So there I was.us, and it's after episode 95 on our website, Into the Wild Blue is the name of his memoir. A couple more quick stories about this, and we'll get out of the way to tease it. My favorite was that they brought in the Stuka pilot from World War II, and his criticism of the A-10 is exactly what we give those guys grief about. Well,
it was too fast.
The other way around. Yeah, we all give them grief. Your airplane's so slow. You replaced the airspeed indicator with a calendar. He's like, yeah, no, it's too fast.
Yeah.
Let's go. Let's pull the handle. Get out of the way. Let's hear the.
Let's get out of the way.
Let's hear the.
This here is a true story.
Don't sound the ejection seat handle.
About crossing the pond.
Now go, don't do it.
No promises. At night, in the world's smallest cockpit, on the tanker, through the weather. Oh, and to the tanker crew who did that. Thanks a lot. We really appreciated that. I'm just kidding. No, I'm not. Well, there I was, crossing the pond, and you could see that I wasn't exactly...
So there I was. It was like 3:30 in the morning. I'm waiting in line to go to Disney World to get on a Star Wars roller coaster. And I was thinking to myself, what am I doing here? Why have I agreed to do this thing and wake up so crazy early for it? And when I showed up to the theme park, I figured I'd for sure get to ride on this ride. And I was already near the back of the line. And thankfully, I got on it and I got in the park. But if I hadn't, I never would have had a book. So because I got my butt up early, I was able to ultimately write a book about the A-10, which I'm grateful for.
What? Yeah. Hey, that I can't wait to hear how that ties in. Yeah. That is a great So There I Was story. Hello, everyone. This is Fig, and I am in Kearney, Missouri, just outside Kansas City on this beautiful day. And where is my cohort, Repeat?
Greetings, everyone. Yeah, Repeat here. Got home last night, as I recall. I think I remember. I don't know.
It was like 5 this morning.
It sure it still feels like it, but, you know, it's getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning and going places. I do that all too often. That's how some aviation tales, most aviation tales, start in my life these days. But we want to bring in a special guest. This isn't some rip-roaring fighter stuff tonight, but it's going to be a real, real interesting evening, I think. Yeah, so we're talking to Professor. He's a professor at Oberlin College. His name is Hal Sunt, and he wrote a book called Warplane, How the Military Reformers Birthed the A-10 Warthog. Let's just jump right into it. First of all, well, let's circle back on that story. You wanted to write a book about aviation. Yeah. I think I wrote down, who was the most fascinating person I never heard of? And I think you even say that in your book. So let's chat a little bit about that and how you came to focus on this subject and choose your subject and go from there, if you would, sir.
Yeah, like 3:30 in the morning waiting to get into Disney World. I'm really intrigued by that.
So the step that got me before I even was writing about the A-10, although I grew up loving airplanes, I have family in Tucson, so Davis-Monthan, and I was surrounded by A-10s kind of my whole life. But before I got interested in really writing about the Hog, I was interested in writing about design more generally. I had kind of a passion for understanding how really well-designed things were built. And through that, I was writing a feature story for a publication about roller coaster designers, because I'd been at Disney World about 6 months prior to that There I Was story. And while I was there, I realized I didn't know how roller coasters were built. Did you go to school to become a roller coaster designer? How does that happen? And I got it in my head, oh, it would be really cool to go to Disney World and Universal Studios and ride on these roller coasters with people who actually built them. And I proposed this idea to a publication and they gave me the green light. But in order to do that, long story short, I had to get to Disney World at like 3:30 in the morning because there was this one roller coaster that had just come out and everybody wanted to get on it. And if I didn't get on it, I wouldn't have a story. And the night was like, I asked the person at the, I went to go pick up my tickets and I was like, what time do I really need to get here? Because I've been hearing that there are lines, you know, out of the park to get on. And she looked at me with a straight face. She said, you need to get here at 3:30 in the morning. And I had a buddy with me, a wingman. So it was like, because I was like, screw this. I'm not waking up that early to go on the ride. Like, and he was like, no, we gotta. And because of that, the story worked out. That ended up being kind of the opening of the whole piece. And how that led to the A-10 was, fortunately, after I wrote that story, a literary agent reached out, so shout out to my agent here, Jack. He said, hey, I really like that thing you wrote about roller coasters. Had you ever thought about writing a book? And at that point, I hadn't. The idea of writing a book just seemed so beyond anything that I could comprehend. But I'd been really interested in the A10 for a long time. And it was these conversations had been happening for a while, but it was right around then when I was really becoming aware of like, oh, the A10's being retired. And I was like, that seems kind of weird because it still seems to be doing its job really, really well. So why is it being retired and how was it built and all of that? Anyway, that got my agent's attention and then kind of the book came from there.
Okay.
But, yeah.
Okay.
Well, that's pretty – okay. I love that story. How did you find the people that you found that actually, crafted this airplane?
Well
– because I read – I mean, I love the book. I don't want to get too far ahead, but I mean, how did you go about finding these guys?
Well, that was the other crazy thing is, so then right after my agent was like, hey, have you thought about writing a book? I was like, I want to write this thing. But at that point, I hadn't even considered – that the person largely responsible for the A-10 coming into being was still alive. Like the airplane was so old. I was like, there's no way this person's still around. But I looked it up and his name, Pierre Spray. And I should offer this real quickly. The language I use around like, he's like the guiding spirit of the A-10.
Right.
A lot of people were involved in building the A-10 and bringing it into being. And I just want to, be clear on that, but Pierre's kind of this main central figure. Anyway, it turned out that he had his own recording studio, and I Googled his name. I found the recording studio, and I just filled out, those like contact us forms.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I did with you guys when I was like, hey, I've got this book coming out.
Okay.
And I was like, I don't know if you'd be open to talking with me, but I'm interested in writing about you and this airplane. And he wrote back to me like later that day, and it unfurled from there. And it starts. I had no connection to him. It was emailing him cold. And then he thankfully vouched for me with kind of everyone else. And it felt like if I had Pierre's blessing, people would be like, okay, I trust you. Pierre trusts you. I trust you. He had kind of a good barometer for that.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So how old was he when you met him?
Oh, goodness. Would he have been right about 80, because I think he was, so he passed away as I was writing the book. Yeah.
Was it right after an air show that you guys went to the air show together or were at the air show at the same time?
So we had visited the Maryland Air National Guard. So it wasn't an air show, but they did kind of a mini private
demo
for us. Yeah.
They were just training. Yeah. That's
to me, I was like, hey, this is great. Yeah.
Awesome.
But we had been talking for a while, but then that weekend we spent a lot of time together. But that weekend in particular was kind of a rather intense weekend because we spent like 3-ish full days together.
Okay.
And at the end of that last day, I had this feeling where not that I could have learned everything I could have possibly learned, but I felt pretty confident that, okay, I've got enough here to really write this story. And then like 2 days later, I heard that he had passed away suddenly. And he would have been, I believe, 83. And that was really weird, like, because I just, I couldn't really write for a couple months because I didn't know it at the time, but I was grieving. I had become close with this person and he had given me so much of his time and was so patient with me. I mean, the way I wrote this book largely was I would at first, cause it was like during COVID, so we couldn't really meet in person, but I call him up on the phone. And I would put my tape recorder and my phone on the ground because I had thrown out my back. So I was like writing on my stomach, but I would I'm just on the carpet. And then I would just let Pierre kind of go. So we would have a conversation and he was just recounting these incredible details from his time in the Pentagon and beyond. I mean, he was just such an interesting part of military history and design history.
Yeah.
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 It really was incredible. Folks, I'm telling you, this is a book well worth reading. Go get it from Amazon. It's well worth your time because I think we were talking pre-show about it. This guy was rubbing elbows with SecDef. I don't know. He was in his early 20s and he's writing memos that are landing on the president's desk. and by the way, not popular memos that a lot of the Pentagon hierarchy wanted the president to see. So that's one of the most fascinating parts about this book is this guy had such gravitas and swagger and he could get stuff like that on the president's desk because he was so damn smart But he apparently was quite humble about it too. He didn't.
Well, and he wasn't a, from what I gathered from your book, he wasn't a yes man.
Not at all. In
fact, he was like the opposite.
He was the no man.
And he didn't give two shits about climbing the, you know, the corporate ladder, so to speak. He just wanted to do what was right.
Yeah, one of the best quotes I heard from one of his close friends, Andrew Coburn, described him as uncompromising for the truth. You know, his allegiance was to what felt true and right. But yeah, I mean, Pierre was like quite literally a genius. So his family moved to the States when he was very, very young, and they settled in Queens. And then he went to Yale. He enrolled at Yale when he was 15 and double majored in French literature and mechanical engineering. I mean,
because those two go so close together. Exactly. Right. Exactly. And I think you described in the book, they escaped through Morocco, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Casablanca, just like the movie with Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. So, or no, the other one. Oh, somebody help me. Don't get old. It's bad for your memory.
Yeah. It's Humphrey Bogart. You got that.
Ingrid Bergman.
Yeah. There you go.
Casablanca. Yeah. That was the name of the movie. I feel like such an idiot tonight. I'll go back to sleep now. Keep talking, sir.
Well, he's, when you mentioned kind of him, you know, rubbing elbows with all these, you know, central figures, part of how I had a feeling that there was a book here, even before I met Pierre or knew of Pierre, really, was I remember I was on a flight from Cleveland to New York. I was like visiting for the weekend, and I landed and I called my buddy and I was like, I think I've got the idea for, or like what makes this a book, the sentence that makes it a book. And my sentence was, the A-10 is like the Forrest Gump of airplanes, and that like its story connects to all these other major moments in history. For me as an aviation buff, you know, a huge part of the A-10 story is the F-105 and the A-1 Sky Raider and all of this, you know, but there's, I had to learn about World War I and World War II bombing and all of that to understand why the A-10 existed. But as part of that, you know, and I didn't know this at the time, but I'm grateful that it happened to be true, was that Pierre was kind of this Forrest Gump figure too. Like, he was moving through time and space and connecting with all these really important people and doing really cool stuff. So in a lot of ways, his life mirrored that of the plane.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. There's the A-1 Sky Raider.
Beautiful airplane, which I wouldn't have, I think, said when I before writing this book. And now I look at it and I see a beautiful thing of rugged design.
Yeah, super durable. And that's for, so go look that up, folks. This is for the folks watching on the live stream. Well, but so he finished, I didn't realize he got to Yale at 15. I'm sure that's in the book and I forgot that detail, but he finished and then found himself wanting to work. He did an apprentice year and then was kept on, and he's like, well, I'm going to have to be in my mid-40s before I'm ever allowed to put pen to paper and start designing airplanes, so I'm not going to stay here with the manufacturer. So can you talk about his path to the Pentagon that got him?
Yeah. So after college, well, in college and then after college, he was working for an airplane manufacturer for a while, and then he was at a conference and was recruited by a member of Robert McNamara's Whiz Kids, who, you know, were known for, that they were brought in to kind of, I guess an artful way to say it is reimagine the Department of Defense. Another way to say it is they were kind of auditing the Department of Defense. So they were not like super popular exactly, but they were bringing kind of new ways of thinking. And Pierre was quite young. I can't remember now the age. Yeah, like mid-20s, and brought on to work with the Whiz Kids. And even within that group that was considered, they weren't renegades, but they were going against the grain. Pierre was like kind of the odd one out, because he wasn't interested in just being a yes man to anyone, and that included the Whiz Kids themselves. So actually his first job with the Whiz Kids, his first assignment was, he got fired from, because it was about troop deployments. They were, I can't remember what the cargo plane was, if it would have been C-130s or what, but they had projected this model for how they would deploy troops. And it was essentially a linear model. Like, the more airplanes that we have, the more we can deliver. And Pierre looked at it and he was like, that's not going to work.
Not going to work.
And what he didn't know at the time was, it's not that he was wrong, but he just delivered that news a little bit bluntly. So his boss was like, look, you're kind of hurting morale here because everybody's really proud of this thing. So we need to move you somewhere else. But so then he got a job within the WizKids where his task was to basically assess how were we spending our money when it came to defense, you know, particularly with air power. And coincidentally, as he was doing this work, kind of analyzing what does the Air Force need, and his conclusion in short was they needed what would become the F-16, which he did a lot of work on with John Boyd, who was his, you know, top mentor, and they were kind of two peas in a pod in a way. But they needed an F-16, or what became the F-16, and a close air support plane, which became the A-10. As he was doing that work, he didn't know this, but there was another gentleman within the Pentagon who was also kind of calling for the need of a close air support plane that would become the A-10. And this gentleman was named Avery Kay. And Pierre would often say, people would say, oh, Pierre's the father of the A-10. And when they would, he would gently correct them and say, actually, that distinction belongs to this other guy, Avery Kay, Colonel Avery Kay, who had been a navigator in World War II. And then years later was saying,
that's right.
Yeah, he was like, no, we need something that can really help troops on the ground. And so the two of them worked together to kind of conceive the specifications, along with a bunch of, or a small group of others who were actually Sky Raider drivers.
Okay.
And that airplane's had such a huge influence on it too. Yeah.
Yeah. Not a popular fellow at the Pentagon, just because of the team you're on. It's like, I imagine it's like internal affairs at a police department, you know, the rat squad on NYPD, you know. And at one point, I guess he had some numbers, and maybe I'm jumping ahead and we'll come back to it if I am. But they actually put out guys and said, go debunk this guy's report before the president sees it so we can kibosh this before it gets anywhere near him. Because it came down to, well, I guess let's back up. Here's the place to talk about it. It was Avery Kay, if I'm not mistaken, who was the one who was trying to defend money for Air Force projects at the cost of Army air support, right?
So Avery Kay had helped basically broker the deal where the Army exchanged their fixed wing aircraft and the Air Force gave the Army their most of their rotary, you know, helicopters and such.
And a big promise.
And then Avery Kay very quickly realized, he was like, actually, we need a suitable close air support plane to support the Army, because the rate at which it was happening, particularly during the Vietnam War, you know, it was taking just way too long to provide support. And as Pierre described, you know, Avery Kay had passed away before I was writing the book, so I didn't get to meet him. But what I learned largely through Pierre is that Avery Kay felt a real sense of obligation and duty to bring a close air support plane into being, because he wanted to support the folks who were fighting the war, you know. But that was just not the thinking at the time. We were, you know, infatuated with high speed, high altitude bombing. The other thing that was actually kind of the design du jour of the time was high speed, low level nuclear bombing, which is what the A-4 was originally designed for.
Right. Yeah.
And which Pierre lovingly called an utterly, a quote, utterly useless dumb shit mission. but he really actually liked the A-4, which was rare. There was, to get his praise on an airplane was unique, but it was those two that were recognizing we need to kind of adjust our thinking towards things. I don't know if I just got off track though with your question. Repeat.
No, I think so. We're going along those lines, but it was talking about Avery Kay and how he, I think you put the quote in your book, was something to the effect of, the A-10 wasn't designed to kill tanks. It was designed to kill the AH-57, I think.
That's right. So yeah. The common joke when talking about the A-10's origins is that we think it was built to kill tanks, but people say actually it was built to kill a helicopter, which is the Cheyenne helicopter, which on paper would have been a really cool design. It was, you know, what the Cheyenne became, or what we ended up building after the Cheyenne didn't really work out, was the Apache, which is by all accounts, you know, a very capable platform.
Oh, yeah.
The Cheyenne was a sort of something like the Apache, but it could fly really, really fast, which in theory sounds great, but with close air support, you know, they often, Pierre and others, touted the value of, you know, slow speed, high maneuverability, but slow speed.
Right. And in fact, we'll get into it in a little later, but there are those who thought the A-10 too fast. And we always like to give the A-10 hog drivers crap, you know, go, hey, man, do you fly the model with the reinforced canopy? Yeah, the back of the canopy in case of a bird strike. Or I heard they took the airspeed out and replaced it with a calendar in the new model, you know.
The folks at the Maryland Air National Guard were awesome. I mean, they you know, gave me so much time. And one of the things that was really cool is they let me fly the SIM, because obviously I can't get up in an A-10. It's a single seater,
other than
2-seat model. But you know, the SIM is quite advanced and developed. And even from that, I was able to, from afar, I want to be clear, I revere what all the aviators and drivers do. So I can't even imagine what it's like to actually be up there. But even from that SIM, I could appreciate how, you know, coming out of a turn after doing like a strafing run, I was like, oh, I wish this had a little bit more oomph just to get up and go. A little more escapability. I felt vulnerable in that moment, even though I'm just on a screen kind of.
So in other words, you just shot the shit out of something. You'd really like to leave the area quickly before somebody gets a beat on you.
Exactly.
Yeah. we've had that same feeling.
absolutely. Although I gotta say, you know, we talked to Vapor, you know, who got shot with a shoulder fired SAM and came down out of the sky, and I've seen photos of A-10s that took significantly more damage.
That's right.
And flew home, brought the pilot back. So that's an impressive machine from that sense. They put a lot of effort into that.
Yeah. Rudder missing. Those airplanes could fly and take a hit.
It's what's wild too is that, you know, Pierre and the rest of his team, when they were, so the thing that they like really designed was, it's the concept formulation packet. It was, here are the specs and here's what we wanted to be able to do. And I don't think they had it necessarily in mind, like the specific type of damage they wanted it to be able to take, but they were like, we want this to be able to get hammered and still make it home in for a whole variety of ways. I mean, I think to have that foresight of designing with the expectation that a lot of stuff's going to go wrong, I just think that's a really interesting way of thinking. They weren't pessimists. They were realists.
You put this in the book. If you could describe this better than I can, please. His analysis was such that here are the hits that this airplane took, and these are the ones that were critical and these that weren't. And he said, you're doing it wrong. You're looking at the airplanes that came back.
Yeah.
Oh, so
right.
That,
yes.
So that is from, that's wasn't Pierre, but was from a mathematician. So this is this famous story from World War II.
Okay.
His name was Abraham Walt, but it directly informed the work they were doing.
Gotcha.
There was this group, I can't remember if Abraham Wald was part of operations research, which was sort of a predecessor to the Whiz Kids. The idea was like, what do mathematicians and statisticians, how can they actually help us fight and win wars? Because when people would doubt Pierre, it's like, well, where's he coming from? But even back in World War II, we had a lot of folks like Pierre bringing their thinking, you know, to the fight. And there was this study where they were examining the damage that B-17s had taken and what would be deemed a critical hit and what would not be deemed. And they were looking at all these B-17s that had holes in the fuselage and everywhere else. They're like, maybe we should put a whole bunch of armor on them. So, cause those are the areas that are getting hit. But these mathematicians, which in theory, you know, at a glance seems like that makes sense, but you can't also just armor the whole airplane even more because it'll be too heavy.
Right. Good gear any bombs in.
Right. And what these mathematicians realized, just their different way of thinking, is they said, no, you're looking at the airplanes that came back. We should be thinking about, what are the ones that aren't here that on the tarmac right now? Where did they get hit? Or where did they likely get hit? And that would have been the wings, because you need that, the wings and the engines.
Yeah.
I guess it could take hits in the wings, but particularly the engines. Once you lose all your engines, you're toast. And that was the kind of thinking that these folks like Pierre and others brought, which is we're looking at the problem in kind of slightly the wrong way. What questions are we not asking? That kind of thing.
Awesome. Oh, that's great. And
it started with what this is going to. This has a specific weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And they said it needs to be a big gun.
Yeah.
A gun,
which gun, hadn't been invented yet, right?
Yeah. A gun capable of piercing massive amounts of armor.
It's so interesting because it literally was built around the gun. I think in that time period, there was much more interest in missiles. And I actually tend to be... And I worked really hard to try and be kind of sympathetic to these other viewpoints because I was trying to imagine, like, it's the 50s and 60s, you know, we're designing all this really interesting new stuff. Of course we want to see if it's going to work out or bring it onto airplanes. So in retrospect, it's like, look, an airplane, if it wants to shoot down enemies in close combat, it likely needs a gun, at least for different, you know, missions and such. With the A-10, it was so unique to be like, before we even think about the rest of this thing and what it's going to look like, we're going to have a gun at the center of the airplane. And in fact, Pierre was so adamant about that. He told me once, he said, you know, if we didn't get that gun, I couldn't have backed the airplane. We needed that 20-foot, 4,000-pound cannon, which, again, hadn't exactly been invented yet. But they had a sense of the millimeter, the round size, examining, you know, tank damage. Yeah, it's a beast.
Look at that.
So yeah, so Styx has a picture up on our live stream of a VW Bug, which is much smaller than this cannon, especially lengthwise. But it looks like the barrel in which the rounds sit at the back of the gun is about the size of the cabin in the VW.
Yeah. Pierre told me they were tempted to have it be as big as 35 millimeter rounds. And I don't know if that actually could have worked with the airplane. They settled on 30. They were like, 30 is what we need to destroy tanks. But I can't even imagine what that cannon would have looked like if it was firing 35 millimeter rounds instead of 30.
Oh, man. I don't know. Fig, have you ever heard this? I think I heard once that it actually slowed the aircraft down if it fired for extended period, 3-4 seconds.
I can phone a friend.
Okay.
While we're talking.
Log drivers I've talked to say it's a myth.
That's a myth. Okay. That kind of makes sense because there's a lot of thrust coming out the back of those motors. But,
yeah.
But,
hey, let's just go with it. Yeah. It slows you down. Way down.
Sounds cool. Yeah. I think part of it is that it fires so fast that if you held it down, I don't know how long of a trigger squeeze you can pull to use the whole rounds, but it's, you know,
it probably wasn't long, 5 or 6 seconds, I'd imagine.
Yeah.
And you're empty. So
we carried 300 rounds and it would be gone in, you know, 6 seconds if you held a gun.
25 millimeter cannon. Yeah.
And
there you go. Right.
Thanks, Styx.
The Harrier did it. Does it have a Vulcan 20 millimeter?
Yeah. Well,
the 25. We had the 25 millimeter.
Gal 12.
Yep. Oh, okay. How did it feel on the Harrier when you squeezed the trigger on the gun?
Glorious.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome. Well, so here's the thing, too. Our gun was set to left of the center line, and it was canted slightly down. That's a 25 millimeter casing.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's still and pretty so big.
Oh, yeah.
When you shot it, it pulled down and to the left, so you'd have to roll in on your target. I mean, if you wanted to put, you know, if you wanted to put 30 rounds in a tank, you'd have to aim at the top right corner of the tank before you squeezed the trigger because you couldn't stop it from walking down and to the left.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Unlike the A-10's gun that was pretty much on center line and in the center part of the plane, ours was underneath.
At 25 millimeters, the rough conversion is an inch. So 30 millimeters, close to an inch and a quarter across piece of lead. Well, depleted uranium.
Yeah.
Right.
So, and the other cool thing I remember reading about this, was it who else? It was Fairchild and who else was the ones that built the prototype?
Northrop. They built the A-9.
Yeah. And they required that the design team required that it not be a paper airplane.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So tell us what that means, please.
So they, Pierre and the rest of these folks, and I'm going to kind of use some umbrella terms here.
Sure.
The group that was largely, that was responsible for the lightweight fighter, which became the F-16, which Pierre was also rather involved with, they were known as the Fighter Mafia. They were a response to the Bomber Mafia. And then the folks who were working on the A-10, some of them were in the Fighter Mafia, and then they became known as this group called the Military Reformers. So for shorthand, I'm just going to use the Reformers, even though sometimes there's some overlap and all of that. But what the Reformers believed in above kind of all else was realistic and rigorous testing. So they didn't want to imagine theoretically what will happen if this airplane gets shot with 30 rounds in the fuselage or in the wing or the engine. They said, no, if we're going to build this to be able to sustain that kind of damage, we need to shoot it with those rounds. We need to inflict the kind of damage that we want to see. They wanted to know, you know, will the self-sealing tanks work? And if we blow out some of the hydraulics, is the whole thing going to set ablaze, or is it going to, you know, continue to keep flying? How is this thing going to actually work out? And as part of that realistic testing and competitive prototyping, they were like, we're not going to just use surrogate rounds. We're going to, at least what Pierre told me, now I don't know all the means behind how this happened. They said, we're going to get Russian weapons off the black market, and that's what we're going to shoot at these prototypes to
make it happen. Awesome.
So both the two competitors were Fairchild Republic and then Northrop Grumman. Would they have merged with Grumman yet? Maybe they were still just Northrop.
I don't recall. Yeah, okay.
And they had to bring three different prototypes to bear. So one to fly and to do gunnery competitions and stuff like that. One that they would test for maintenance. And then one that they would test for durability. And the durability one, the Reformers and the rest of the design team, or the kind of testing team, they requested that it be kind of delivered in parts so that they could shoot different parts of the airplane with different types of rounds and see.
That's so cool.
The thing, what was helpful is one of the other really notable Reformers who spent so much time talking with me and I was really grateful for was Chuck Spinney. And he ended up being on the cover of Time magazine in the early 80s.
Okay.
And he told me that Pierre was the ultimate empiricist. And what that means basically is that rather than projecting into the future of what we hope something might be, Pierre based all of his thoughts on design with what had happened in the past. What has proven to be a need or what has proven to work? And we're going to use that to inform what we build next rather than, oh, wouldn't it be great if something could potentially do X, Y, or Z? Yeah, there's Chuck Spinney. So that's a shout out to him for giving me that language of like the ultimate empiricist. And what's kind of surprising is what Pierre found to be the most, or maybe that's not surprising, but what Pierre thought was the most useful information when he was working on the A-10 and other weapons platforms was to, one, speak with pilots, speak with the folks who were flying or getting close air support, that kind of thing, but also like pilot memoirs, war memoirs, all of that. He said that was incredibly valuable and incredibly useful in actually informing how we build this stuff. So he required his whole team to read this book called Stuka Pilot by Han Kuhle, which is a really interesting.
I'm sorry, say his name again. I think you broke up a little there. But
Hans Rudel.
Rudel, yeah. Hans Rudel, R-U-D-E-L,
yep.
Who flew for Germany in World War II and is credited with something like 500 some tank kills in a Stuka, which could only, I think it could only carry something like 24 total rounds.
Because it was a one-shot cannon.
Yeah, which is what you swoop in and then miss and you begin this whole thing over again. And he wrote this memoir that's, it's really interesting. It's kind of bonkers because his devotion to flying was, you know, rather fanatic. But it gives you a mindset into what it takes to do the job. And so he wanted all the folks building the A-10 to read that.
And they actually brought him in, right?
They did later, after the A-10 was already
built
and everything. And I can't remember the circumstances of how, because they invited him, and then I don't know how widely it was publicized, but it was interesting because they were then able to ask him after the fact, what does he think about what the A-10 became? And one of his main critiques was that he thought it was too fast.
Right.
Yeah. He had a quote. His quote was, when hunting tanks, speed is poison.
Yeah.
Because it's just, which again is one of those things that like, it sounds obvious when you think about it. It's like, oh, it's harder to see the ground and to spot stuff that's hiding when you're going really fast. But at a glance, you're like, that's so unusual. Of course we want to go higher and faster and all of that.
Sure. Sure. But yeah, he talked about, you know, they'd hide it in a barn with the cannon sticking out of the window, and he'd fly by the barn and go, oh, there's a barrel sticking out of that barn. I know it's in there.
Hey, I want to backtrack real quick when you were talking about the testing and the prototypes that they required of these two manufacturers. And I thought it was interesting that they wanted the pilots to fly both airplanes, but you know, the same pilots fly both instead of, you know, each factory or each competitor having their own pilots. I thought that was a game changer too.
Right.
Yeah. Pierre was super adamant about that. He didn't want test pilots. He wanted specific, like, active combat pilots. Nothing against, well, I don't have anything against test pilots. I think what he wanted though was folks for
users.
Whom, yeah.
Yeah.
For
whom, users.
Yeah, who are the folks who are going to be presumably at that time hunting tanks in the Fold of Gap? People are going to actually be doing it for them to be flying the airplane and them doing it. And another thing why I got so interested in this is, I mean, I was always loved to airplanes as a kid, but the more I got interested in the idea of design, what the A-10 embodies is this thing called human-centered design, which is a very popular buzz term now, which is we design things so that they're easier for people to use. Part of what informs human-centered design is this thing called participatory action research, which is a really fancy way of saying, let's talk to the people who are actually going to use this thing to or who are going to be supported by it to inform how we want to build it. So Pierre never told me, you know, I'm an advocate of human-centered design. However, I'm sure he was, but he never used that language. But that's totally what these guys were doing, and that's why it's, you know, rather easy to fly and use and all of that. But that's why they wanted the specific pilots, the attack pilots, to fly the plane.
Right, right. And let me jump in and say, and I know you didn't mean this as a pejorative, that it's easy to fly. The airplane itself, I've not flown it, may be relatively easy to fly in its responsiveness and that sort of thing. Probably one of the most difficult missions. Fig, I know you dealt with those guys as forward air controllers. They're snooping and pooping in low level in the mountains of Korea and marking targets for us and giving us nine line briefs and shooting Willie Pete rockets onto the target they want us to bomb, and how they didn't scrape themselves off in the hills and kill themselves every week, I have no idea. It is probably one of the more difficult missions to actually fly. It's impressive to watch those guys work.
Well, and I'm sort of jumping ahead here so we can return to it too, but just as you mentioned that point, because what inevitably comes up with the A-10 is, okay, now it's being retired, and oftentimes stuff with the F-35 comes up, and I've learned that can be a bit more contentious than maybe I anticipated. but what all of these folks who are involved with the A-10 and Pierre and the reformers, first of all, Pierre and the reformers, one of their mottos was people first. They were not beholden to one piece of technology. In fact, shortly after the A-10 rolled off the assembly line, Pierre was like, okay, we need to build something better. He didn't particularly love the A-10. I mean, he loved, unquestionably, was the folks who fly it. And he told me that he only kind of learned this in an intimate way in recent years when he started to meet a lot of folks who were hog drivers. And what he came to appreciate was the culture of close air support and what that means and just how much work goes into knowing on almost a telepathic level what's going on with the guys on the ground, and you're up in the air and you can know and feel that. So your point about that, you know, the connection between facts and hog drivers, or cash drivers, I should say, in general, not just hog, is a special, special thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was just an incredible thing to watch those guys do that mission and to work with them, as you know, they would be forward air controllers for us airborne, but then of course they're also dealing with their own forward air controllers and doing close air support for Army. And I suppose sometimes Marines, I don't know of any specific occasions, but actually I'd like to backtrack a little bit because we were going down that path and we did talk, you mentioned it and I looked it up. Northrop and Grumman merged in 95. So it was still just Northrop when the competition was in place. Would you talk a little bit about what they did? You talked about they're going to take Soviet weapons from the black market. Can you talk about their disappointment in the testing process? That's one of the funniest stories.
What, is this with the tanks?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Out in Nevada.
Yeah. Yeah. So, two things. One is that the gun actually wasn't ready when they were still choosing between the A9 and the A10, but they were able to make their assessment with all these other kind of data points. I think they were using a 20mm Vulcan in that testing. But then once they were like, okay, we've got the A10, now we're going to really test the gun. Oh, and there's just on the feed here, there's a picture of the A9, which is...
Yeah, there it is.
Kind of a sleeker version of the A10. And by all accounts was a very solid, you know, prototype. The A10 just beat it out slightly. But once they had that and they're like, okay, we need to really get to work on the gun, what they insisted on, again, with this realistic testing, is they said, look, we don't want to just shoot at surrogate tanks, at least not at first. And so through a variety of means, which were not fully disclosed to me, and that's probably for the best, they were able to procure a few Russian T-62s. Because that's, I believe that it was T-62s.
That sounds right.
Yeah. And they hauled them into the Nevada desert, you know, the Nellis Range under the cover of night, under tarps, and set out this array. And then afterwards, they were bringing in other tanks as well. But first, they needed to determine, can this thing kill a T-62? And they're firing they're going on their test runs, and they, you know, squeeze the trigger, they hit the tank, but then they don't really see anything happening. And they're like, oh no, like what, like, oh shit, what have we done here? And at this point they were testing out, or at least some of the ammo they were testing out was DU, depleted uranium. And they were still learning kind of how that interacted when it hit a tank. And so at first they're shooting the tanks and they're realizing, oh man, we're not getting any kills. What have we done here? But then they noticed after a couple minutes, I can't remember how much time would pass, that slowly smoke would start to billow out of the tank. And that's because how DU operates is it hits and then it really does its damage after it's already entered, and it's pyrophoric, and so it lights stuff on fire. And so it would light, you know, the gas and the ammo and whatever else. And then they realized, oh, all these times that we thought we weren't getting a kill, maybe we actually were. And once they were able to account for that, then they could really ramp up the testing. But it was a funny moment where at first they thought, oh shit, have we screwed up here?
We've wasted all this time and effort, and we're not even we're not even scratching the paint. It turns out they weren't scratching the paint, but they were incinerating the internal of the tank. Right.
Including all the soft bodies that might have been in there. Hey, and this reminds me, in Stuka Pilot book, and you mentioned this in your book, you know, he had credited with 500 and some tank kills. Well, he probably had quadrupled that many, because they had to have, to get credit for the kill, they had to have a witness see smoke or something, right?
Yep,
and
yep.
Chances are he had killed, you know, four times as many tanks, but nobody stuck around long enough for the after effects.
Exactly. Yeah. And the requirements were so stringent that you're right. Not only did he have to see the smoke coming out, but someone else had to be like, yep, he's telling the truth.
That's wild.
Nuts. And his Rudel's flying tech, this is sort of just an aside, but since we're talking about it, you know, he was flying a Stuka, I believe it was the G model. So that's the one that had the two really big cannons under. And the way he would attack is, he said he would fly almost like a drunken man. Like he would, like Cougar when he's trying to land the airplane.
Top
down, and he's like this. And because he had to avoid getting hit, which made it all the more impressive that then at the last second he could straighten out and place two bullets on the, you know, two rounds on the target. Yeah. Crazy stuff.
Yeah. Oh, shit. Well, okay. So we may have glossed over this when we were talking earlier about what led up to this. You know, the Air Force was higher, faster, you know, nuclear, no guns on airplanes, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And it was the really the kind of the shit show of an operation in Vietnam with the 105s, you know, trying to do that mission, trying to do the ground attack mission in an airplane that was really not suited for that. Where does Ed Heineman come into this story?
Yeah. Ed Heineman is the airplane designer that Pierre said he had the single most respect for. And okay. Ed Heineman built both the A4 that you folks flew and the A1 Sky Raider.
Okay.
And his he had a motto that he had inherited from, I think it was Gordon Hooten. A few people have used this motto, but Pierre remembers seeing a plaque on Ed Heineman's desk that said this, that said, "Simplicate and add more lightness." So that was always his strategy, was the way we're going to, because usually airplanes, when they're getting built, is we want to add more and more stuff on there. But he, lighter and cheaper, the better we can do, the better the airplane will be. So that's who Pierre, not like idolized, but really looked up to and
okay.
and yeah. loved his airplanes.
And the A4, yeah, obviously we didn't fly the A1, but the A4 was an amazing jet. And yeah. it just, from its lightness, its simplicity, you got in. You started it up, you fired up the tachyon and the radio, and you went flying.
I saw a quote from there was an article or book about the A4, and there was a Skyhawk pilot who was quoted as saying the first time he flew it, he got up there, and he was sort of like anxious because he's like, what am I supposed to do? It's like in, I can't remember what movie, that Will Ferrell movie, where he's like, what do I do with my hands? Oh, Ricky Bobby in Talladega. He's like, he's up in the A4, and he's like, it was so easy. I'm used to having to flip all these knobs and all this stuff, and this is just good to go.
And you wore that airplane.
You just said you wore that airplane?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was on a cross-country flight not long ago, and the pilot used to fly A4s, and he said that exact term. He said, you wore the A4.
Yeah, literally in the cockpit, yeah. your shoulders touched both canopy rails, and so you just felt like part of the airplane.
I'm not a large human. You know, I'm 5'9" and 100 and, you know, when I was in the Marine Corps, I was 155 pounds, and with the flight gear on and everything, I fit perfect in there, but it was tight. I don't know how big guys flew that airplane.
Oh, dudes like Penn and stuff, how they fit in the A4?
I don't know. No, I held big guys told me they'd have to sit in there and cock a shoulder forward to get in
and then, and then straighten out. But it was a sweet bird. And then the roll rate on it, I mean, it was so damn fast. It was transonic.
And 720 degrees a second roll rate. Wow. If you went max stick to flight.
Yeah, 720.
It would bang. There was no, you could not keep your helmet from hitting the canopy. Even though you were holding the stick and you knew it was coming, your helmet would hit the canopy because the airplane would roll so fast.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, in fact, I have a story about that. On my first solo, it's like, Max, got to do it. Got to do it. Not supposed to. I was about 18,000 feet, and it's about 360, 380 knots. Slammed the stick all the way over, and somewhere between two and three rolls, I managed to get the stick back to neutral, and I was inverted about 30 degrees nose up, coming through about 180 knots. Then the nose falls down on me, and I'm kind of looking at the ground, and it's still coming around. I got everything neutralized and got my airspeed back, but it uncaged my personal gyro, I'll tell you what.
So the airplane had a really amazing roll rate, but it was very stable longitudinally. You know, when you're landing, it was just a pleasure to fly. It was like a little sports car, and there wasn't no fly-by wire. No, you know, there was no controls out there doing stuff without you know it. I mean, if you wanted it to move, you had to make it move.
Yeah. This was like just one of the, or what was so fun for me about writing this was I grew up, so I'm red-green colorblind. I found out when I was maybe 12 or 10 or 12, something like that. So then I was like, okay, I can't be a pilot, or at least not in the way I'd want to be. But I would consume all of these books, you know, all those books where it was just airplanes and statistics, and I would memorize the payload capacity of a B-17G and whatever.
Yeah.
And as I was writing this, I was like, oh, it's so cool that I get to learn about all these other airplanes in order to understand the A-10, because it is connected to all of them. So the A-4, or Fig, you mentioned, you know, the F-105, which was really important for the A-10's development, because it had some issues where they would catch fire really easily. And that was because it's actually, I think, was a well-designed airplane, but it was being used for a different mission. It was supposed to be for, you know, low-level, high-speed nuclear bombing, and then they are using it for other stuff. But I got to, you know, I was reading Jack Broughton's Thud Ridge and, you know, really appreciating that. I mean, ironically, the F-105 has now become kind of one of my favorite airplanes, you know, flaws and all. And the guys who flew that had serious guts. And so.
Yeah, they did. Just, I enjoy reading those books too. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So my favorite air museum in the country is in Tucson at Pima Air and Space. And what's cool about that air museum is it has aircraft from all the different branches, and also like they've got some MiGs and stuff as well. And walking through that museum is like a story of aviation. And I wanted this to sort of feel like that. Like, yeah, it's about the A-10, but it's like, oh, we're going to talk about the A-4 and the F-105 and the Stuka and, you know, these other platforms too.
So you mentioned there's a small mention in your book, you know, about, well, the F-117 and how, you know, how it came about, you know, sort of not so much how it came about, but, you know, it was, you know, there's not one aerodynamic surface on the whole damn airplane. And I had
it's like pushing Legos through the air.
Yeah. Yes. I had the pleasure of flying at the airline I worked for, you know, 20 years ago with one of the pilots that was the initial cadre of the stealth fighter. And, you know, he was based at Nellis, but he would leave on a Monday and, yeah, there's a picture of it, and come back on Friday back to Nellis. And, you know, he couldn't tell his wife where he'd been or what he'd done, because they were standing up the first squadron and they were only flying at night and that sort of thing. Well, anyway, my to get to the bottom of this, he told me he was on night one of the first Gulf War, where he, you know, basically flew right down Main Street in Baghdad. In my mind, that airplane, you know, was fast and it was invisible. No, first of all, it wasn't fast. And for them to deploy their weapons, they were straight and level, wings level, autopilot on. He was just sitting there like this with, you know, tracers and things going all over the night sky. And he was just
sounds like B-24 guys going through the flak stream.
I hope this stealth stuff works. Because it was on autopilot. And he was just sitting there going, I'm trying to think small. I'm trying to be really small right now. You know, because they couldn't see him. They were shooting in the air at you know, noise and everything else. But, hey, you know, big sky, you know, little bullet. Well, sometimes it's a big bullet, little sky.
Right.
Still, where do you think, you know, after writing this book, where do you think we're going? You know, they're retiring the A-10, which is, there's nothing to replace it. The F-35 is can't do what that does.
Yeah. I don't know what the I'm going to probably sound too diplomatic here, but I don't know. The short answer is I don't know, because there's not a sort of another platform to take it over. To be clear, we were talking about this the other day, but there's a lot of F-35 drivers who have a lot of really positive things to say about that airplane. Yep. That airplane does a hell of a lot of things extremely well. Yep. The notion that the A-10 can just be retired and there's nothing to step into place, that it's hard to see that working. What the reformers and Pierre and all these folks would offer as a counter, which I think is kind of the most perfect counter argument, is they said, look, we're not beholden to a piece of tech. What we're beholden to is the people. And so somehow or another, it's that culture of close air support that needs to be preserved above all else. Now, I think there still needs to be a tool that facilitates that. Mm-hmm. Something like the A-10. What that is, I don't know. And I was talking with some folks too about, and I'm sure I would love to hear kind of your guys' thoughts on that because I think that's kind of a question of like, what does the future of war look like?
Yeah.
It's like a broken record. It always seems like we're going, well, we're never going to do that again. So we're going to be, we're going to always be standoff. High tech's going to win the day. But at the end of the day, we find out, nope. Or still somebody's kicking indoors,
right.
Somebody's on a roof of a building asking for a strafing run or a small diameter bomb to be put right in this doorway,
yeah.
Right? So,
and you do talk about that in the comparison in the wake of the Gulf War, the 117, mm-hmm. and their claims of incredible survivability, but it was apples to oranges, and I think you did a nice job talking about how the A-10, it flying in the same hours and the same missions as the 117 was as survivable.
Yeah, particularly when you account for the, because A-10s flew so many more missions than F-117s. Right. There's a really interesting report, which I think, if you're curious in reading a 280-some-page report from the GAO, although I think it's quite well written.
Yeah, but I get a lot of insomnia, so that should help.
But it's their assessment of kind of all of the tech that was used in the Gulf War, and they juxtapose the F-117 with the A-10 and debunk some of the kind of myths of like the F-117 being this perfect airframe, which is, I remember as a kid watching DVD or not DVDs, VHS tapes of, aircraft from the Gulf War. And
sure.
When it got to the F-117, it was all this just raving positive news. And the GAO report indicated that it's not that the F-117 was bad. In fact, it also did a lot of stuff extremely well, but it was not like the cure-all. It's not like, oh, we could just have a fleet of F-117s and we don't need anything else. And that's what they were kind of tempering. And so what a lot of these folks were often cautioning against is, hey, we found the belief that, hey, we found this thing that will, kind of fix the problems of war forever.
Right. Like the Norden bomb site would.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So, right. Yeah. Could put a bomb in a pickle barrel.
They actually did when they were advertising the Norden in the 40s, they had some kind of celebration at Madison Square Garden, and they did some kind of demo where a pretend airplane literally dropped a pickle a mock bomb into a pickle barrel. Like they really leaned into that image.
It did. It worked great. Unless there were winds, turbulence, flak, maneuvering aircraft.
Well, and then there was the flak.
Yeah.
And the German fighters.
Well, that's one of the things, that was so eye-opening for me. So there's a bunch of great books that I'll just shout out here because, they were so helpful to me. There's Robert Coram's fantastic biography of John Boyd. There's Jim Fallows' excellent book, National Defense, which is writing about the reformers in the early 80s, late 70s. But the stuff about thinking about bombers and flak, Masters of the Air by Donald Miller, which is now the series on Apple. That book really opened my eyes to how brutal it was to be flying in those bombers, through those strafing runs, or not strafing runs, through those attack runs, bombing runs.
I think you did you mention it was like trench warfare in the air?
Yeah, that was so in Donald Miller, his book is so great. And in it, he was talking about how, guys are getting frostbite. They take off their glove and their hand gets stuck to the thing. They're asphyxiating or they're vomiting into their mask. Just awful, awful stuff. And I was like, geez, this sounds a lot like the stories I've read about how brutal it was in the trenches in World War I, except now we've just moved the trenches 20,000 feet in the sky. It's kind of ironic because the whole reason we built bombers was to try and get away from that.
Break away from trench warfare. Sure.
Yeah.
And then... Yeah, I'll tell you real quickly, I got a ride in a B-24 once. Long, cool story how I managed to do it. Met a guy in the Newark Airport Lounge, and turned out we're both pilots at the same airline. And he invited me. He says, I'm going to be, in your town next week. I'm like, well, I'll be back next week. So I took my son, and we went over to the airport, and we got a ride on a B-24. And one of the things that struck me was there's a catwalk between the front part of the airplane and the aft part. And during flight, you could walk along that catwalk. And he said, 3 points of contact at all times. Catwalks may be 12 inches wide. Mm. Like, okay. He goes, because if you fall off that catwalk, the Bombay doors were closed. He goes, it's slightly thicker than aluminum foil. You're going through it.
Wow.
And I was like, that skin, it's not a pressurized airplane. That skin is there. It's flimsy. And yeah. I was like, oh, man. They look solid. He's like, no, you're going right through it if you fall.
Wow. Like,
yeah, what a different world those guys lived in. And then my then 12-year-old son could barely fit into the top turret. Like, how did grown men fit up here and fight the war in 20-degree weather after being up there for 4, 5, 6 hours or longer?
We had a B-24 nose gunner on our...
Six weeks ago.
His name was, he went by Rosie, and he was 19 years old when he was in Europe in a nose of a B-24. Yeah. He flew 32 missions, and the war ended before. That was at the time they had to do 35. Yeah. I mean, he had some stories.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. He said one of the things he said. I think we titled the episode. You could hear the flak hitting the airplane or the shrapnel hitting the airplane.
Holy cow.
Yeah, what those guys did, right? Greatest Generation, is in no understatement, is what it boils down to.
Absolutely.
So, Styx is asking, have you heard of Matthew Syed, Black Box Thinking?
No.
Okay. He says it was an analysis of B-17s returning from a mission. So, I guess we chatted about that earlier a little bit. Talking about the mathematicians were the ones saying, okay, you're looking at the ones that came back. Those aren't good studies of what's survivable or what isn't survivable.
There's this other book, this guy, I think it's Jordan Ellenberg, and that's where I learned a lot about that. But it wouldn't surprise me if that's in another or mentioned elsewhere too. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm going to take the time here and mention yours again. It's Warplane, How the Military Reformers Birthed the A-10 Warthog. So that I'm telling you, folks, go get this book and read it. It's a fun read.
It's a fast read. I mean, I read it fast because I was totally into it.
Here's the thing, Fig. I read it fast, and I thought, man, I've got half the book to go. And I went back to read the rest, and I had like a page and a half, and I'm done. I'm like, whoa, wait, because I'm on my Kindle. I don't know how much book is left. I've got a lot more to read, and it's all the research and end matter that he's put in there to prove how well. You know, he's backed up everything. It's a great, fun read.
I'm not blowing smoke, Professor. It's very well written. I felt like I got Pierre Spray's personality. You know, I kind of knew how he was by the way you described him.
Really
well written.
Yeah, could you talk him up a little bit here, please?
Yeah.
Talk about your time that you spent with him, and from your first meeting to your last.
Yeah. And just one thing I'll mention here, too, you know, for me personally, hearing that the book feels like a fast read is I'm so glad, because in my mind, the kind of the human centered design is I wanted to read something write something that hopefully didn't feel boring or feel like a slog. And I know people don't really it seems like people don't buy books in airports as much anymore. But in my mind, I was like, I want to write the kind of thing that my dad would pick up in an airport bookstore and read on his 6-hour flight to London or something like that.
Sure.
And so that's really cool to hear. Pierre was, I mean, just incredible. He was so patient with me because I would call and then we would chat for, so at first we're chatting just on the phone and we would have these conversations that are 2.5, 3, 4 hours. And it was like trying to drink out of a fire hose. Like he's just saying all this stuff and I'm frantically writing down these notes. And then I'd go back and do research, and he would give me all these books that I should read, and so I would study those as well.
And I'd come up your homework.
Exactly, yeah. And I would have all these follow-up questions. So in a good way, the progress I felt like I was making was sort of 2 steps forward, 3 steps back, but because I would be going back to then fact-check or do more research or whatever and make sure I really understood it. And he, you know, was just so, so patient. The following year is when we got to spend a fair bit of time together. For our first interview, I mean, he I remember feeling kind of embarrassed because he was going to meet me at my hotel to do the interview. And I wasn't staying somewhere fancy. It was, you know, some hotel along the highway or whatever. Like I was, you know, writing on a budget.
Motel 6 in Tucum County.
Oh man. Like I'm sorry. You know, they don't really have a, you know, a nice conference room where we can meet. And he was like, I don't care. And like, we just did it at a random side table. And I'm like, this guy, Pierre Spray is just wholly unpretentious, you know? And the last, our last interaction after we spent this long weekend together in Baltimore was we finish our last interview and then we're sitting out by his car and I had like a tuna sandwich from a grocery store, but I didn't even have any napkins or silverware or anything. I was like, this is all I have to offer. Do you want to eat it? And he was like, yeah, sure. And you know, he wasn't fussy or anything. He was just a really down to earth guy, and it just speaks to me. He was so highly respected because nobody kind of questioned once they were talking to me. They were like, okay, Pierre vouched for you, like you're good. And that just is such a testament to wow, who he was. And he had such eclectic interests, you know. He loved music and jazz, and there's this great story I love of, I was talking to a hod driver who said one time he went out with Pierre and they went out with folks. I think they were from DARPA, I think. But they were in D.C. and they were having drinks somewhere. And then Pierre was like, oh, I know a place close by. It's really great. We should go. And they go in and it turns out they're at this like very hip club with it, where it's all like kind of young people dancing and really loud music and all. Like
Pierre took you guys.
Yeah, Pierre's like in his late 70s. And the square is in the Pierre sat back and he looks at the guy and he goes, isn't this great? The acoustics are fantastic. You know, that's what he was thinking about. I was just like, what a guy. He, in the Pentagon, you know, he when I say, I often thought he was kind of like, he's maybe the coolest person I've met. Not in that he was like cool in an off-putting way. He just felt very secure in who he was. And when he worked in the Pentagon, you know, he was wearing turtlenecks and ascots and you know, tweed blazers and that kind of thing. It was just, which maybe don't sound like bold style choices, but relative to what everyone else is wearing in the Pentagon, you know.
In the 60s, especially, yeah, when I'm imagining it was very buttoned up. And
dark blue suit, white, you know, white shirt, blue tie.
Yeah. Exactly, exactly.
Except not Pierre.
Yeah, yeah. So he was just so, he was so interesting in that way. Yeah.
That's cool.
That is,
it's really cool to talk to you and hear you describe him, and you know, and it's really neat that you got to spend time with him.
Oh well, thank you.
And he's a legend. I mean, really, he's a legend.
Yeah, it's the, I think it was the Baltimore Sun, or no, maybe it was the Washington Post. In one of those publications, they quoted his obituary. Quoted that another publication called him, and you mentioned this at the start, but probably the most interesting person you've never heard of. If you're just kind of casually not involved in things like, and that totally embodies who he was. I mean, he was quite the guy.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of people walking around today with their fathers and a lot of, and brothers and mothers and sisters and all that. Cause a lot of women flew the airplane too. And a lot of ground troops that are alive today because of the airplane that he designed and insisted on the quality that they put into it as far as supporting the pilots.
Really enjoyed the opening of the book and how you tied that in.
Oh,
that
was thank
really,
you.
That was really good.
In fact, you know what? I think we should, I want to start helping out all our wonderful Patreon supporters. And so I think what we'll do is after this, we'll tell that story of the opening of the book. We'll circle that back in.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Okay.
Great.
And that way the Patreon and direct donors will get a link to talk.
We need to tease it. We should tease it a little
bit. We should tease it. It's a real life mission in Afghanistan. Yeah, the guys are alive today because of the A-10.
Yeah, there was a JTAC on the ground and they were doing overwatch for an army unit and they got ambushed. And the bottom line is A-10's close air support saved the day.
They were here to save the day.
and thanks to, you know, the hog driver community, they were able to put me in touch with the lead JTAC on that mission and the two drivers who were providing close air support.
Okay.
And that mission, there's still footage you can find of it on YouTube. Okay. I don't know if it's still used in training now, but it was considered, their like cockpit camera view was like considered the gold standard for how to provide close air support.
Nice.
I found it odd that they both didn't get the DFC, only the flight lead.
Yeah.
Come on, right?
Yeah. So his call sign was FATS. Do you happen to know how he got that? Do you have that?
Yeah, so it stands for Fatally Allergic to the Sun.
he must have had a mild complexion.
Yeah.
Maybe he was a ginger.
Albino or something, you know? Wow. Yeah. Oh, that's funny. That's an excellent call sign. Okay.
We've been at this an hour and 20, almost 4 minutes.
Yeah. So it's time that we land this airplane and we'll go into that for the Patreon supporters and the direct donors that support us here. We usually say thank you for our service because we have a lot of military members on. You haven't served in the military, but you have served the military. And I think you've served the public at large that can then, I think, if nothing else, after reading this book, demand that their representatives demand that more people like Pierre Spray work at the Pentagon.
Well, yeah, no kidding.
Well, thank you. I mean, that really means a lot. The what I was just so touched by, and not to sound overly sentimental here, but what Pierre and other folks would talk about so much with the hog drivers and the hog community was that how humble they are. And the humility that they exuded. And it took me a while to really hear that and know what that meant. And just every hog driver I've spoken with has been just so kind and humble and warm and gentle in a way, which is sort of an odd paradox given what the hog does, you know, but I'm just so, I was so struck by that and it was just an honor to get to spend time with all the folks who agreed to speak with me, and doing something like this is so cool. Cause you know, as a kid, I wanted to be a fighter pilot and for various reasons I couldn't be. And this is like the closest I can get to it. And it's really cool to, you know, be sharing, you know, airplane stories with a bunch of drivers.
Well, you did
there it. You go.
You did it very well. And as a side, you just triggered this. I have never met an A-10 driver that I didn't like. Mm.
They are good guys. And gals. But guys, you know, stop it. Trying not to be woke here. They're good guys.
It's a generic.
Generic guys, yeah.
They're training, it was cool. Like, I know, maybe this isn't just exclusive to them, but like part of the, when they go to flight school, they kind of like go to charm school, like where they're learning to be, to be humble. I mean, they probably already come in with that mindset, but like that's something that's really coached and cultivated and really cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Well, I think it is probably time that we land this airplane. I think, as we always do every week, and I don't want it to be trite or that we're just saying it to say the words, thank you to everybody who serves currently, who has served, and to all the families who support them. They couldn't do their job quite as effectively if it wasn't for all the sacrifices being made on the home front. And that includes the little ones who get birthdays without mom or dad around, folks that don't have brother, mother, sister around, and for those of you who just celebrated Easter with an empty spot at your table, thank you for all your sacrifices. We are humbly grateful that we live in a nation where people like you step up and give of yourself so much that we have the freedoms in the country we live in. So thank you. A couple of other quick things I wanted to mention. Another $100 from Michelle Langseth this week. Thank you so much. Wow. Hard-earned money being given to us. We don't know why, but you're doing it, and it helps keep our tanks full. So thank you. JWH. That's all I got, Fig.
Call sign?
Inits. All we got was initials.
Inits.
Inits.
Call sign Inits.
Call sign Inits.
Thank you. Thank you, Inits. New section lead.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Very, very humbling. Thank you.
Indeed. And you remember we were talking to Rosie about being a B-24 gunner, and you mentioned he wrote a book and he would never publish it, and that was just for him. After talking with us, he came back and said, you know, I really didn't know what to expect. I was kind of nervous about talking to you guys, but after a couple minutes, I just settled right in, and I was shocked that you guys wanted to hear my story. You didn't want me to tell what you wanted me to say. You wanted to hear what I had to say, and I became very comfortable. And based on that, he shared his book with us. That's up on our website. So there I was.us. It's after episode 95. It's right above that on our website. He gave us his book. It's in PDF format. So there I was.us. And you'll find it. It's between episodes 95 and 96. You can go right there and read it. It's about 67, 68 pages. His memoir of flying in World War II and enlisting.
Into the Wild Blue.
Yeah.
Into the Wild Blue. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. So amazing stuff. We probably mentioned a term or two tonight, and we didn't circle back. So if you didn't get it, what do you think, Fig?
Well, we got a glossary.
Yeah.
And if it's not in the glossary, well, please reach out to us at Styx at sothereiwas.us, because Styx is really the brains behind the operation. Styx and our man Bago. We're pretty good at keeping acronyms, explaining them, and at least getting them in the glossary. We may have zipped right past them tonight.
Bet we did. Absolutely.
JTAC, like JTAC.
Yeah.
Did we talk about what a JTAC is?
Joint Terminal Attack Controller. Yeah. Oh, sorry. I interrupted
you. No, please. Go ahead. Go ahead, Professor.
Yeah, Joint Terminal Attack Controller.
Nice. Sure.
It's a forward air controller, really very specialized, and that's who controls airplanes on the ground.
If Fig Styx put it up there, what's a nine-line brief?
Ooh, what is a nine-line brief?
Yeah. I don't know. I never flew a CAS mission. Did you?
Yes.
Yeah, there you go. So I can't tell you the order and the items, but it's basically everything you need to know to put bombs on target to support your Marines or your soldiers on the ground. It's what the tactical forward air controller tells you. You plug that into your brain and your computer, and you put bombs on target and save some lives. It's very specific. It's difficult to give a good one. It's more difficult to receive one and drop weapons. Probably the most difficult thing I ever did in a Harrier was take a nine line brief and get weapons on time on target. So
yeah, here's your nine lines. The IP, heading, distance, target elevation, target description, target location, what the mark's going to be, where the friendlies are, and your egress heading.
Yeah.
Now, we used to do that verbally, but nowadays you can get it in a data link.
And of course
you
can.
If you're really, really, really in the shit, you only need some important ones, like where the friendlies are, what your target is, what the egress heading needs to be.
Yeah, yeah. And probably the exact target location, because you could get it down to inches now.
Yeah.
You know, they can plug it in and give it to you in inches. But holy smokes, yeah. So, hey, if you want to look cool, Fig, what would you do?
Well, speaking of that, you got to tell me how much I owe you. We have a merch store, and you know, if we don't have it on the merch, it's probably not made. But shirts, hat, bikini. I don't know, Professor. I don't know if you got a significant other or not, but it's bikini season. We got a pretty hot bikini on our merch store.
There you go.
Coffee cups, shot glasses, koozies,
clocks, towels. Beach towels. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's all there. Yeah. We need to get like a director's chair or something too. That'd be a good one. So, hey, let's also say thanks to Brad Silcott over at BDSAviationPhotography.com.
Great pictures. Great pictures he sent.
You want to see some of his work, go to our Facebook.com/sothereiwas.us. He's got some of his pictures up on the page. The Harrier's coming up on its last air show demo ever about a month from now. And he has photos of both the VMA 231 bird and the VMA 223 birds that are painted for that last air show. Gorgeous. It's like you're standing on the flight line looking at the damn airplanes. The photography is so good.
Yeah.
So, wow, how does he do that?
Hey,
so,
raise your hand if you're going to be there.
Oh, I'm in.
Oh, hey.
I'm in. So.
I didn't see it. Hold on a second. Put your hand up, Bago. There he is.
There you go. And I guess last but not least, certainly not least. Well, no, we got two more thank yous actually that we have to do. First of all, we want to thank none other than Dave Hamilton. He's got the Mac Geek Gab, the Gig Gab, and the Business Brain. Those are shows that he does, but he has several shows that fall under BackbeatMedia.com online, and they handle all kinds of advertising for all these other shows. Dave, thank you for your expertise, your support, your knowledge. and getting advertising for this show. When we have it, we're grateful for it. So we appreciate that. You have a show and you need advertising, reach out to backbeatmedia.com and see if they can't help you out too. Then I can only think of two other people we should thank. Fig. Well, not one.
You know, but it's the Dose. That's two. The Dose Gringos. Those are the guys. That's the music that you hear in the background. That's their music. And
love it.
They're the two Air Force F-16 pilots that make the Air Force sound good.
I turned on
four albums, not a bad song.
Nope. I turned on a guy to it this week while I was out on my trip. So
and somebody wrote in to us and said it was our listener from New Zealand. Not going to say his name. He got all four albums and donated $100 to their charity.
That's where I heard that name from. Yes. God, that's right. Yeah, we put him and Tripp in touch with each other to make that happen. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, very cool. Well, everybody, that kind of wraps it up for this week. Go
Thank
get
you,
the
Professor.
Book, Warplane, How the Military Reformers Birthed the A-10 Warthog. You'll love it. We certainly did.
It's a great read.
Yeah.
Fast, great read.
Yeah. And so let's not forget, until next week. Stay safe and don't sit on the ejection seat, Neil.
Don't do it.
Well, there I was crossing the pond, and you could see that I wasn't exactly fond of all the shit I was wearing on that day. Now an F-16 is cramped enough, but it's even worse with all that stuff supposed to save your life. But we knew there was no way. Cause when you're going down the North Atlantic, man, it's over.
I think he said it's over.
I just want to tell you both, good luck. We're all counting on you.
And we are out.
It never gets old.